I have shared many moments of pride with you. Pride in the ability of the Congress of the United States to act, to meet any crisis, to distill from our differences strong programs of national action.
In these words, spoken but 4 days after he became our 36th president in November 1963, Lyndon Baines Johnson paid high tribute to the ultimate strength and achievements of the Congress of the United States. And it is the Congress at work to which we look now. For the work of Congress finally plays such a vital role in the life and well-being of each American citizen as it duly determines the laws we live by. How then does Congress pass a law? We can follow a typical sequence of legislative steps from the time an idea is first proposed through the passage of an appropriate bill by both houses of the Congress ready for presidential signature. This sequence is long established, and each step has been determined within the overall framework of our fundamental respect for the traditions of democratic government. We have spoken with some of the men and women of the United States Congress. They will be our guides as we trace this typical legislative process, as we see how Congress passes a law.
Mr. Speaker, members of the 88th Congress, one step above all is essential. The enactment this year of a substantial reduction and revision in federal income taxes. Now is the time to act. We cannot afford to be timid or slow. For this is the most urgent task confronting the Congress in 1963.
Often, the President of the United States will suggest legislation to the Congress in special messages or as here in his annual State of the Union address. Thus, President John F. Kennedy had come before the members of Congress in January of 1963 and asked them for a tax cut. He later spoke of his proposal in different detail.
Here is how it will work. The typical American family, a father, mother, and two children, earning about $6,000 a year, now pays an annual tax of $600. This bill will cut that tax by 25%. As these typical families and millions like them across our country spend that extra money on dishwashers or clothes or a washing machine or an encyclopedia or a longer vacation trip, or a down payment on a new car or a new home. That's what makes jobs. The businesses which serve them need to hire more men and women. The men and women who are hired have more money to spend. These individual benefits, of course, are important. But the most important benefit goes to the nation as a whole. We're talking about a tax cut in the pockets of our people that will help create jobs and income for everyone. We're talking about one of the most important pieces of legislation to come before the Congress in 15 years.
We shall use the passage of this legislation as an example of the Congress at work. Of course, each congressional act has a life force and a life story of its own, but the basic procedures followed here in most important respects were those typically followed whenever Congress passes a law. At the time he placed the proposals before Congress, President Kennedy anticipated congressional action on the tax bill.
I think we're going to get a bill for a tax reduction, which will provide a consensus. It won't be perhaps the bill we sent up, but I think it will be a good bill.
Proposals for legislation are first presented either in the House or in the Senate. But the Constitution does specify that revenue legislation must originate in the House of Representatives. So it was that President Kennedy's tax proposals were placed before the House, and Congress began its work. The study, the formulation, compromise, and debate, which would bring forth, in this instance, the Revenue Act of 1964, incorporating tax cuts that went into effect in March of that year. Both houses of Congress operate by means of what has come to be called the committee system. Legislative proposals are not initially considered by all 435 members of the House or all 100 members of the Senate. Instead, they are referred to committees that vary in size, but are small enough to permit the business before Congress to be transacted with considerably more ease than would otherwise be the case. The chairman of each committee is almost invariably the member of the majority party who has served longest on the committee, the result of that respect for seniority that is traditional in the Congress. Congressman Wilbur Mills is chairman of the powerful Committee on Ways and Means of the House of Representatives. A Democrat from the state of Arkansas, with over 25 years of service in the House, what Chairman Mills said about committee work relates generally to all legislation before the Congress. Sponsorship, subject matter, and committee assignment may vary. But the outlines of the committee system, the procedures which shape legislation, remain much the same in almost all cases. Chairman Mills told us how a committee begins its work, the first steps in the consideration of a presidential message, and he stressed the key role that committees play in our legislative process.
Most of the work of the Congress is done in committees. There are 20 standing committees in the House of Representatives. The committees review legislation pending before them, hold public hearings, decide which of the various proposals they should recommend to the House for enactment. Each of these committees has assigned jurisdiction under the rules of the House. For example, the Committee on Ways and Means, which has been a standing committee of the House since 1802, is assigned jurisdiction of taxes, Social Security, tariffs, custom laws, and a few other less major subjects. Since each of the committees deals with such assigned jurisdictions, they become expert in these fields, or at least we're expected to become expert in these fields. Each committee also has a professional staff, which is, in fact, always, I think, expert in its fields. We have been lucky in securing top-notch personnel. It would be impossible, in my opinion, for the House to function without committees. It's difficult enough, even under present circumstances, any individual member of the House has the privilege of introducing any number of bills any day the House is in session. We have to depend on the committees to do the basic work, to screen legislation first, to make decision with respect to what it will consider and what it will not consider. It isn't necessary for a committee to consider any legislation. We have not passed adversely upon any that we've not considered. It's just that we have not gotten to them. We haven't had time to go through all of them. In general, a major piece of legislation originates by way of recommendations from the administration. The president transmits proposals to the Congress in a special message. This was the situation in the case of the Revenue Act of 1964. Normally, any administration in control of government will take into its confidence members of the Congress who have particular expertise within the area of the subject matter. The President and I did confer at great length on the proposal that later became the Revenue Act of 1964 before it was ever submitted. Our relationship was very fine, very cordial, very close. Our consultation went beyond even the framework of the proposal itself. It went back so far as to a discussion of whether or not we could have a tax reduction. I had discussed matters of taxation with my constituency throughout the entire district. Over a period of many years, I had talked to all sectors of the economy in my district and in my state, including farmers, businessmen, laboring people, housewives, self-employed, employed people from all walks of life. I think I had a clear understanding that the people of my district favored rational and fair tax reduction. We had a great number of proposals contained in the president's message. All of these had to be very carefully reviewed, carefully analyzed. We had no bill to begin with. There was a great deal involved in the development of it. In general, on any major piece of legislation, any committee of the Congress will announce public hearings on the proposals, giving sufficient time before the hearings start for the interested public to study the proposals and determine whether or not a particular person wants to appear and testify at the hearing and on which side of the issue. If so, he will submit a request, will be scheduled for the hearings.
The first major step in the consideration of any important bill by Congress, the committee hearing is designed to give members the wide range of information and opinion that they will need as they go about shaping legislation on any subject. Mrs. Martha Griffiths, a Democratic congresswoman from Michigan and a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, told us just how extensive and valuable a committee hearing can be as she recalled some details of the hearings on the tax bill in 1963.
The Ways and Means Committee held public hearings on this bill that lasted 26 days. And when I say 26 days, I mean that during that 26 days, the committee began hearing witnesses as early as 9:30 in the morning, although it was usually 10. And they continued as late as 7 o'clock at night. Now, during that time, of course, the Secretary of the Treasury appeared, the Budget Director, the Council of Economic Advisors. But anyone can come in and testify who can make arrangements to appear before the committee. Now, on the tax bill, I believe some 275 people avail themselves of this opportunity. Many of those people speak for vast industries when they speak. Others speak for individuals. Others speak for smaller industries. This is one of the ways in which the public pulse is known.
Many groups, large and small, went on record for and against the tax proposals, as they would in the case of any important legislation pending before Congress. In other words, they lobbied. They made their views known to the members of Congress. Frequently, a lobbyist will testify before a committee. Mrs. Griffiths feels the word lobbyist has come to have an unfortunate ring to it, but she sees the lobbyist as making a real contribution in many cases as a member of Congress considers a bill.
In general, lobbyist is a word with bad connotations in America and in the English language. But in fact, it shouldn't be so. A lobbyist first must know the business that he represents, and he must know how the laws that are proposed will affect that business. It is impossible that any one member would know with any degree of perfection the workings of millions of businesses. Therefore, a lobbyist has some value in American politics. Some of them are quite valuable. I would say that the views of the administration, the views of the public generally, are quite effective in helping people make up their mind how they will vote on legislation, particularly at the committee phase. When you enter a committee hearing, sometimes your own views are made up more of prejudice than of fact. And you have an unique opportunity to find out the facts.
Mrs. Griffiths clearly feels that committee hearings are of great value as a member of Congress studies legislative proposals. We had further confirmation of this when we spoke with Congressman John Burns, a Republican from Wisconsin and the ranking minority member of the Ways and Means Committee as it considered the tax legislation. Congressman Burns then went on to describe the second stage of committee activity when it meets in executive session and actually decides upon the provisions of a proposed law.
I don't think the committee, frankly, could function if we didn't have the advantage of all of the various types of information that we get through public hearings. In this 1963-64 tax bill, it covered a wide, wide range. We had almost every cabinet officer before the committee telling us how it would affect them. We had major groups such as the labor organizations, such as the business groups, the Chamber of Commerce, the manufacturers associations, and then state associations. It covered the whole gamut. There'll be some witnesses that are wholeheartedly in favor of them. They come in and they appear that this is a good proposal. Other witnesses will say, oh, it's terrible and shouldn't be enacted at all. And then you have some that come in and say, well, we see that there is a problem and there is something that should be corrected here, but the administration proposal goes too far. So that you get on each individual proposal a wide range of viewpoint as to really what should be done. That leaves the committee to try and figure out and determine and hit upon through a consensus within the committee the most reasonable approach to the legislation. Because really there's a second stage after we get through the public hearings. I'm referring to the executive session of the committee where we, in a sense, go behind closed doors Everybody's free to speak his mind. We go through the legislation in detail, and questions are asked about every conceivable impact that a particular provision in the bill might have. We talk about the bill as an overall proposition and its effect economically and so forth. We talk about the individual segments of the bill. Almost every we look at the dot even and the commas and the periods to make sure that the final result is what we intend. Now, you'll get controversies at times by reason of a philosophy. It may not be political. We have divisions in the committee. There may be formal votes. If any member desires to have a specific vote, it's put to the members of the committee to make a firm decision. In many cases, there's no real hard, fast controversy. There may be little disagreements that adjusted through compromise or a better understanding of what the other person's viewpoint is. It's amazing what happens at times just through discussion and arguing. After all, legislation and legislating is a matter of compromising. And if the greater proportion of the provisions of the bill you agree with, just because there are some other items in the bill with which you disagree, you'll still support it. It's a matter of arriving at a compromise, and it's the best you can do. So that it's the whole process. But they look to the chairman for their leadership, and that gives him a great deal of power, of course. It's the chairman that decides, number one, which bill will we take up, or will we take up any? Will we just sort of relax and not have committee meetings? Most chairmen use their leadership with discretion, and they attempt to be fair. And they try to do what a chairman's real duty is, to keep the proceedings orderly and accomplish something. Then, of course, we vote to either recommend the bill to the House for action or vote against recommending it.
Once a committee has completed its consideration of a proposed bill, its chairman is responsible for recommending action to the full House of Representatives. In congressional language, this is reporting the bill. Chairman Mills spoke to us about this procedure.
A report is written explaining and justifying the legislation. The bill is ready for House consideration. It's actually dropped into a little box that we call the hopper at some time on a day when the House is in session. This is the first time that a bill is available to the public. This is the procedure which we followed in the case of the Revenue Act of 1964. It's the procedure which we generally follow. The committee, however, was in a position that it could have reported the bill in all probability earlier than in September. It did not do so. It did not bring it to the floor of the House until it was definite that the membership of the House itself had reached the conclusion that had been reached in the Ways and Means Committee, that it was appropriate at that time to pass legislation so greatly reducing the rates of taxation. One can be here, of course, as long as I have, and get to some views about what one can do and what one cannot do as far as the House is concerned. You do have to develop some degree of legislative sense, of feel, and of timing. There's no doubt about that.
It is not necessary that a committee report to the House be the unanimous decision of all committee members. Congressman Burns outlined an alternative that is available to members who do not share the opinion of the majority, and told us how this division of opinion plays a key role in the rules of debate which operate once a bill reaches the floor of the House of Representatives.
In this 1963-64 tax bill, the Republican members of the committee all joined in a statement of what we call Republican views. We favored tax reduction. We said, here, this bill is fine. If the administration will change its attitude as far as the increases in spending that they're now telling us they have projected, but we could not support it unless there was restraint. We thought the overall effect would be not in the best interest of the nation. So that's where the crucial focus of conflict came as the bill went before the House of Representatives for debate and for final action. Each bill is assigned, when it's scheduled for consideration by the House of Representatives, a certain amount of time, 2 hours, 5 hours, 2 days, 3 days, for debate. The debate is under the management of the chairman of the committee, who represents the majority party, and the ranking member of the committee who represents the minority party. If it's a four-hour debate, they'll each be granted 2 hours of time. It's up to them, therefore, to assign this time to the various individual members who want to speak on the subject. In my case, the Republican members have looked to me for their time. And so you try to give them as much time as they feel they require. And you end up with one speaker on the minority side, and he finishes up, and then you have the final word by the majority, and they finish it up. If it's a bill that provides for amendments, and then you move into the amending process, each member that has an amendment can offer an amendment, and he's given 5 minutes. And then anybody that gets recognized by the speaker can have 5 minutes in opposition.
The scheduling of a bill for consideration on the floor of the House is handled by the House Rules Committee. Indeed, this powerful committee determines not only when a bill reaches the floor, but sometimes whether it reaches the floor at all. Decisions made by the Rules Committee also set forth the length of time a bill may be debated and the terms by which amendments are permitted or not permitted. The power that the Rules Committee thus possesses can be decisive in the passage of legislation. And the committee, with what has sometimes been life or death control over a particular bill, regardless of majority sentiment, has long been a center of controversy. Tax legislation usually reaches the floor in a manner which does not permit amendment. This results from a request made of the Rules Committee, which Chairman Mills described for us as he noted the action taken by the full House of Representatives in the case of the Revenue Act.
Once the Revenue Act of 1964 was reported to the House, our committee decided by a majority vote that we should ask for a so-called closed rule. This is a rule which we request the Rules Committee of the House to grant us. The Rules Committee is the engineer, so far as the legislative process is concerned, in getting to the floor of the House. Under this rule, no amendments can be offered from the floor of the House. And I think our committee perhaps utilizes the closed rule more than any other committee. If we went to the floor of the House under the procedure allowing amendment, the entire Internal Revenue Code would be subject to amendment on the floor. We could create some situations that we would not want if we adopted amendments on the floor without committee consideration. We might be there for 2 or 3 weeks at a time before we completed action. To me, that is not the orderly way to consider legislation. There is always the opportunity under the closed rule for motions to recommit, which means that if a majority of the House should vote for such a motion, the bill is referred back to the committee. It would then die in the committee. Or a revised bill can be reported to the House, which would be acceptable to a majority of the House. In the case of the Revenue Act of 1964, the motion to recommit was rejected, and the bill passed the House on September 25, 1963, in the substantive form in which it was reported by the Ways and Means Committee.
President Kennedy had addressed the nation in the week before the key vote in the House, strongly urging passage of the tax bill.
The bill on which the House will vote next week is a sound bill, and we need it for many reasons. I do not say it will solve all of our economic problems. No single measure can do that. But this bill is the keystone of the arch.
The tax bill passed the House of Representatives by a vote of 271 to 155. But no bill becomes law without the approval of both houses of the Congress. Senate consideration lay ahead. New concerns would be voiced. Somewhat different procedures followed. For each House, in its special way, gives to the law its shape and meaning.